This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Future Farm Botanicals Liquid Turmeric Liposome Complex, a natural solution to chronic pain. Future Farm's liquid turmeric with liposomes and nanotechnology delivers maximum absorption for effective pain relief. Sourced and manufactured in the United States, this product contains 1,600 milligrams of curcumin and powerful antioxidant properties. This plant-based curcumin is used to possibly reduce inflammation, block proteins that trigger swelling, and intercept inflammatory pathways, significantly decreasing inflammatory responses. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Don't live with pain when there's an all-natural, science-based remedy that works without adverse side effects. Get free shipping on all of your orders at myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're going to talk to my favorite integrative cardiologist about COVID-19. But we're also going to, you know, just take a sort of a free-ranging look at how to support your cardiovascular health. Dr. Sinatra is a frequent contributor here on Intelligent Medicine. I always enjoy his perspective. He's got deep experience in both conventional cardiology as well as being a pioneer in integrative approaches to heart health. And he's known to many of you through his excellent informative website, healthydirections.com. That's where people can find out more about you, right, Stephen?
Oh, yeah. Healthydirections.com is sort of the nutritional, you know, vitamin website, so to speak. But and there's also a lot of information on heartmdinstitute.com as well. A ton of information there.
Great. Okay, so, you know, I wanted to talk to you because I wanted to get your unique perspective as a cardiologist about COVID-19. And it appears, you know, at first we thought, okay, COVID-19 is like a bad flu. People had terrible respiratory symptoms. Sometimes it got in the lungs, and people would have to go on ventilators, and sometimes they would succumb because they simply couldn't breathe. But it seems that there are some other kind of scary manifestations of this, and this has been highlighted in the press lately. Stories are now circulating about cases, albeit rare, where relatively young individuals, apparently without cofactors, they're not obese, diabetic, or hypertensive, they may be in their 20s, 30s, or 40s, are having strokes. Oh my goodness, what's up with that?
Yeah, this first of all, you're absolutely right. This virus is an incredible challenge to the medical profession. And unfortunately, it's changing every day. In other words, what we said maybe a few weeks ago, and I've been up in this virus with a lot of our colleagues that we share in common about this, and sometimes it changes. So,
are you saying that the virus is changing or that our views on this are changing? Because I can think of
our views are changing because what we talked about maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago isn't holding up now. A case in point.
Right.
I'm calling you from Florida right now.
Right.
The cases in Florida several weeks ago weren't bad at all. Now all of a sudden we're getting 2,000 cases a day. Mm-hmm. At first we thought that the virus was very susceptible to heat and humidity.
Yeah.
But I think that theory has been blown apart
right now
because Florida is getting a lot of cases. In fact, it's kind of scary now because you're in New York City, correct?
Yeah.
You're at ground zero.
The thing about it is that because we were hit so hard, it's now estimated that, double digits, maybe as high as 20 or 25% of the populace has been exposed to it. And perhaps we have developed, not full herd immunity, but there's been, some speed bumps interposed in the progression of the virus because so many people have already developed immunity to it. It's these other states that have been relatively spared that are now spiking, it seems, right?
Correct. I agree. And I think that that's going to be the savior for our nation is if we get herd immunity.
Mm-hmm.
If that happens, we're in great shape. And that's sort of the scenario with any virus.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, Ron, you and I have been around a block long enough to know that when any respiratory virus hits, any flu-like season, people go to the ICU, people get intubated, people get what we call myocarditis, usually happens a few to several weeks later. But I can remember after every flu-like illness, when I was in charge of the ICU or CCU at our hospital, oh my gosh, a few weeks later we'd be seeing more and more cases. So any flu is
people get heart attacks. I mean, this is well known, is when you get a respiratory infection, it does something to you. When you have a fever, it's more cardiopulmonary stress. You know, your heart rate goes up. It's kind of like sitting in a sauna. You know, it puts a stress in your heart. But also, there seems to be some thickening of the blood, perhaps, what's termed a coagulopathy that occurs around these things.
Yeah, there's been a lot of theories out there. And one thing about this virus, it can cause what we call a hemorrhagic or a blood clot situation in the lung. And you know, can it be related to what we call a cytokine storm, where the body's putting out so many inflammatory messages that to try to counteract the virus, that these inflammatory cytokines actually can cause, you know, hemorrhage or blood clotting. You know, that's a theory. Another theory, which is kind of interesting, and I don't know if you and I have ever commented on this in previous broadcasts, is that these places in the world where there's a high degree of electromagnetics, like New York City, for example, like Wuhan, China, Northern Italy, Spain, these pockets of the world where there's a lot of, you know, Wi-Fi and I call it electromagnetic soup, you know, can this interact with the virus and put us into double handcuffs, so to speak? And some of the scientists that I know in this part of the community, the scientific community, say it can be a factor. So, I mean, certainly, one of these things this virus is bringing out is it's almost like the perfect storm. In other words, if you do have comorbidities, if you do live in an environment that has a lot of electromagnetics, if you do get exposed, all these factors come into play. And I guess it boils down to our immune system. If our immune system is razor sharp, but not too overactive, so to speak.
Yeah, balanced.
But not dull, like an elderly person or a person with cancer or comorbidity, so to speak, like heart disease or diabetes or obesity, you know, any of these factors, well, then, you know, you have a really good chance that you're going to get a fever and maybe get a respiratory illness, and that's going to be that, and that's it. And that's what we have to hope for going forward.
Do you talk to, I mean, I know now, you know, you're doing integrative medicine, and it's been a while since you were in the cardiac care unit. But do you talk to some of your colleagues who are still on the front lines, and do you discuss some of the innovative strategies that they're using to, you know, perhaps prevent some of these problems? Maybe they're using blood thinners early on in patients who are very sick. Is that a plausible strategy?
Yeah. In other words, people are trying to, you know, plug up holes in the dike, so to speak. You know, at first, early intubation, as you know, was being incurred. And then all of a sudden, 80% of people on ventilators weren't getting off ventilators.
Yep.
Then they were lying people on their stomachs instead of their backs, you know, to see if that would make, you know, a difference. And then they were putting people not on ventilators, despite the fact that their O2 saturations were very low. I mean, I gotta tell you, Ron, I think doctors are so challenged by this virus because it's out of our repertoire of
they're sort of making it up as they go along, you know, and you know what we're doing now is very different than what was done in the very, you know, first few weeks of this. I think they learned some painful lessons that you know, the hue and cry was ventilators, we need more ventilators. And then it turned out that, you know, we had enough ventilators, but not only that, putting people on ventilators sometimes was a death sentence.
Yeah, it was. And again, you know, what are you going to do when the O2 sat drops so precipitously? Because, I mean, you and I have been in CCUs and ICUs, and we've been there before. And when the oxygen drops, you only got a few minutes, maybe a few seconds to make a decision.
But you've got a paradoxical situation now, and they've coined a term for this. They call these folks happy hypoxics. Which means they may be, you know, sitting up in bed, banging away on their iPad, and then their O2 saturation is like 86%, something which would send us into a frenzy of intervention to try and correct, but somehow they seem to be acclimated to it, and maybe, you know, I'm not saying that we know all the answers, but maybe less aggressive ways of supporting their oxygenation would be appropriate.
Right, right. And that's why, you know, people are doing all sorts of things, you know, even laying somebody prone. I mean, can you imagine when we were in the ICU, CCU 20, 30 years ago, we would be laying people the opposite way on a ventilator? I mean, it's unheard of. But yeah. I guess, you know, medicine is medicine. You got to use what you have. And if something doesn't work, you can't keep going back to the same old thing. You got to try innovative situations. And I think that's what the newer docs are doing. And I got to tell you, Ron, my heart goes out to these younger docs in the ICUs, CCUs, ER. I mean, what they've seen, you know, has been a baptism by fire.
Well, it kind of reminds us, and I think you recollect this here, the days of AIDS, you know, the early days in which we were coping with patients. And we didn't even quite know what we were dealing with. They were 4-plus sick with all these disease manifestations. We weren't even sure how contagious they were. You know, should we be wearing spacesuits? You know, we subsequently learned that it can only be transmitted through a blood stick or, you know, through sexual contact. But it was a worrisome situation, and we were on the front lines, and, you know, we really had no tools. And I really can empathize with the doctors who were struggling valiantly to come up with strategies. So this being something that can affect the heart, are there implications for integrative medicine? I think the best offense is a good, the best, well, they say the best defense is a good offense. So is there something that we might suggest preemptively to people to perhaps make sure that they don't have highly clottable blood or that they have optimal heart function should they come down with something?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, one of the things that came out very early out of Wuhan was they did a study in China. It was a small study, Ron. It was about 420 patients. But 19% of them, after they survived a respiratory infection, came down with a myocardial illness. Now, you know, the term that we doctors use is myocarditis.
Yeah.
But this is almost like 19% out of 400 is a big number. Of these patients.
Sure.
Now, again, we've all seen, you know, myocardial complications, but now, you know, they're thinking that this virus, because the lung and the heart share a similar circulation, that the virus is not only toxic to lung tissue, it's been shown it's been toxic to brain tissue, GI, you know, gastrointestinal tissue, and some people get really bad abdominal discomfort and diarrhea, and cardiac tissue.
Mm-hmm.
So the virus, it's not selective for, you know, a particular, you know, organ. Although at first, Ron, talk about controversy.
Yep.
The European Congress, Heart Congress, and the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association, they were at odds because of this ACE2. Have you heard about the ACE2 receptor and,
yes,
and ACE inhibitors and things like that?
It's like the docking station for the virus. And, you know, the concern is, you know, should you get off your antihypertensive medications, or conversely, should you be put on them because maybe it's going to help that ACE2? And it was, you know, it was back and forth on that for a long time. What is there any resolution to that question?
Well, no, it's still up in the air. And the reason why I bring it up is you and I both know when we were treating patients on a day-to-day basis. If you go to a doctor over a particular complaint, you may get five different opinions from five different doctors.
Exactly.
I mean, everybody knows that.
Wait, you know, doctors know that, but patients don't know that. Patients are surprised.
Yeah, patients
they think this is rocket science. You know, it's like, no, there are a lot of controversies in medicine, and sometimes we don't know the precise answers. We're humbled to that fact.
Exactly, and when major medical societies, not individual doctors, are fighting about, you know, this coronavirus, so it's problematic. I'll tell you, it's not an easy situation, you know. So I just think, you know, your listeners or, you know, people that are exposed to the virus or live with the virus, you know, I think the simple things matter. You know, I think the sunlight's good for you. I think washing your hands is good for you. Wearing a mask, I mean, some people say it's controversial, but if you do have the virus and you're wearing a mask, I think you're going to protect other people. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, the list can go on and on, but yeah. I think, you know, a lot of simple gestures can be incorporated where, you know, we can actually deny or give ourselves protection about, you know, getting the virus.
You know, coming back to this heart involvement, you know, the condition is called myocarditis, you know, an inflammation
of the heart. Yeah.
Right. And the experience in China is very interesting because I just read a paper out of China where they say that something very interesting is happening in China is China has both the highest and simultaneously the lowest levels of selenium in its populace.
Right.
It's a big country. There are parts of China where there's very, very low selenium levels. In fact, as a cardiologist, you probably know about something called Cashan's disease, which is a form
of cardiomyopathy. Yeah.
Cardiomyopathy.
Right.
So it turned out that was caused by a virus, Coxsackie virus. So what did they do? The Chinese government said, okay, let's undertake this huge program. You know, it's a socialized country there. They're very authoritarian. They said, everybody in Cashan is going to get some selenium. And they virtually eradicated this Cashan's myocarditis. And so the suggestion is that selenium may play a role, they speculate, in COVID-19. And in this study, they actually sampled people's selenium levels, and they could actually predict the severity of the COVID-19 infections based on the selenium levels. And that's just one among many nutrients that may play a role in providing protection, but it might protect the heart from this myocarditis. I mean, it's a very interesting possibility.
Well, you know, I've always liked selenium for years. I mean, let's face it, selenium, when you take it with vitamin C, and the body forms glutathione. But when you take in selenium, vitamin C, and with the body's natural glutathione, it forms the antioxidant that we call glutathione peroxidase. Mm-hmm. And that's the most supporting immune-enhancing antioxidant in the body.
Total free
so
radical quencher.
Sense.
Yeah.
Exactly. It makes a lot of sense. And, I mean, you and I both gobble up vitamins and minerals like crazy. I mean, I take selenium every day.
Yeah.
You know, I think zinc is another one of these interesting minerals. And I think one of the hospitals in New York was actually doing a study. Maybe it was New York Hospital, but was it called Langone Medical Center?
Langone, that was NYU. That's where I trained.
Yeah, yeah. NYU. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Basically, I thought they were doing a study on zinc as being possibly as good as hydroxychloroquine.
Right. Well, typically when they give this combo, this cocktail hydroxychloroquine with azithromycin, they should include zinc because it's thought, you know, as you know, that one of the modes of action of hydroxychloroquine is that it's a zinc ionophore. It actually helps zinc get to where it needs to go to in the cell to do its job, you know, against the virus. So totally
right.
Makes sense. And, you know, maybe that's why some of these hydroxychloroquine studies have come up short, because they simply didn't add the magic ingredient, zinc, to allow it to do its work. And apropos of that, you know, as a cardiologist, you know, they point out that it's dangerous potentially to use hydroxychloroquine, right? You know, this is it's been really, in fact, I think the latest I heard in the news is that they have removed the FDA approval for it was like an emergency use approval, an EUA for hydroxychloroquine for this disease, and they removed it because they said, "Oh, the studies are not panning out, and it could be dangerous." You, as a cardiologist, I mean, this is an old drug. You probably saw a lot of patients on hydroxychloroquine.
I did.
Does it mess up the heart? I mean, is it? I mean, did you encounter that a lot?
I never saw it, to be honest with you.
Okay.
You know, in other words, hydroxychloroquine allegedly increases what we call the QT interval.
Yes.
Now, I've seen a lot. Now, the QT interval is basically an electrocardiographic event, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's a timing. It's a timing device of the Q to the T interval on the electrocardiogram. Now, there are certain syndromes. We see them in cardiology, prolonged CoQT intervals where people can experience sudden death. I mean, we've seen this, okay? It's rare, but I have seen it. So when the hydroxychloroquine issue and the QT interval issue came out, everybody was privy to it. We were looking for it. And, you know, I discussed it with some of the colleagues I know that were using it. And, you know, some of the studies showed that hydroxychloroquine prolonged the QT interval. But the people I spoke to, we weren't seeing the swing in ventricular tachycardias. Right. We call it Torsade de Pointe.
It changes the EKG, but it does not necessarily express itself as a dangerous or life-threatening arrhythmia usually. I mean, it can happen. It's been documented, but it's not a routine finding. It's not like the coup de grace for patients with COVID-19.
Let's face it. Aspirin. People who take aspirin. 19,000 people a year die of GI bleeding just taking aspirin, right?
So
would you take hydroxychloroquine? I mean, as a heart specialist, if I came down with, you know, COVID, I would take hydroxychloroquine in a heartbeat. For five to 7 days? I mean, who cares?
You know? It's been tainted.
I mean, sometimes the media runs with the wrong tape, you know?
It's been tainted, unfortunately. You know, it's become a political controversy because Trump, you know, kind of offhandedly said, oh, you know, it's very hopeful, hydroxychloroquine. And then he admitted he was using it, which made it even worse. So it polarized opinions on it. I think we still need to take an objective look on whether it helps. But, you know, I got to say at the end of the day.
Studies. We're all for that. Absolutely.
At the end of the day, you know, in 2 or 3 years, if this is still around, I think hydroxychloroquine is going to drop by the wayside. We'll have better, you know, that's kind of an ad hoc, improvised, approach for this. And it may work to some extent, but it probably isn't going to end up being the magic bullet that's effective against COVID-19.
Yeah, Ron, did you see the recent retraction by Lancet, the New England Journal of Medicine?
What a fiasco,
Yes, that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Probably the two oldest journals in our, you know.
New England Journal, too.
In our growth and development.
Prestigious journals.
Came out of the 1800s, right?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the two best journals in the land of medicine retracted two fraudulent studies against hydroxychloroquine.
Right.
So think about that.
Politization
on this is horrible. It's really horrible.
Let me put it to you this way. You know, you're like the foremost advocate of the clinical application of coenzyme Q10 in cardiology. And I will accord you full credit, and you popularized it. And let's say you wrote a paper on coenzyme Q10 for cardiovascular disease and submitted it to the Lancet and to the New England Journal of Medicine. How many years of exhaustive review would it take? First of all, they would reject it anyway, ultimately. But how many rewrites, how many times would it be batted back to you? What would be the latency period between when you submitted it and when it would be published? And here, this fly-by-night outfit with five employees with no track record whatsoever gets to publish two studies in prestigious journals, like almost on an emergency basis. I don't get it.
No, it's amazing. And I'll tell you this, Ron. I mean, you're privy to grounding and earthing, right?
We've done
interviews on what grounding and earthing does to the human body. I mean, first of all, it thins the blood and it supports heart rate variability, which is like the most amazing thing you can do for your cardiovascular system. When we showed that earthing for 45 minutes to 2 hours thins the blood, I'll tell you, in my 50 years of medicine, this was the greatest discovery I ever made, and I couldn't get that published in 8 major journals.
No.
I mean, I was shocked.
No.
I was literally shocked out of my mind. And I'm a reviewer for major journals. I review for these journals. Can you imagine?
Well, you know what? There's a word for it. It's called confirmation bias. In other words, if they already had it out for hydroxychloroquine, they welcomed an article that would say that it doesn't work. Grounding sounds too woo-woo, and it's just not on their radar screen. No way, no how. You know, and it, as much as you could, you know, show in a double-blind, placebo-controlled fashion, I don't know how ever you did it.
We did it. We only had 30 patients, but it's in the blood. And you know, in this day and age of electromagnetics and high carbohydrates diets and high sugars and, I mean, you name it, you know, pollution, insecticides, pesticides, the amount of diabetes, the blood sugar situation, the real risk factors in cardiovascular disease is sort of like red ketchup blood. We need red wine blood. We need our blood to be thin, not overly thick. And again, that's what the COVID-19 does. It literally causes thickening and clots and then hemorrhagic of the basement membranes of these little capillaries. So, you know, thinning the blood, I think, is going forward is going to be a major factor in the prevention of cardiovascular disease in this century.
Okay, Steve, a good point at which to pause because, as you know, we divide our podcast into two parts. In part two, I want to get into a little bit about a program for cardiovascular prevention, maybe some suggestions for immune support. And I want to get specific about grounding because that's been a big emphasis for you over the past few years. And we'll focus on that momentarily. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with Dr. Steven Sinatra today.